Hi, you're listening to the free podcast of the Majority Report. Every day, Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m., it broadcasts live, and the podcast is available shortly thereafter. If you haven't become a member yet, I ask you please to become a member at majority.fm, your support which allows me to do this program. You can also support the show by buying some coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It is all fair trade, and it's, of course, a co-op. So the people who are going to be sending you your coffee also own the company. You can also support the show by buying products, if you are one to buy products, through Amazon via our Amazon link. You can find that at majority.fm in the book and DVD shop. You don't have to buy books and DVD. Just find the link, bookmark it, buy products from there. You'll be transferring money from that corporation into my pockets. Well, maybe not so much my pockets, but Evan and Dorsey, our producers, may actually be able to buy a lunch for the first time this week. All right, folks, here is the show.
It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny-ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Okay, I'd like to welcome to the program Naomi Klein. She's, of course, award-winning journalist, bestseller author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which follows No Logo, and, of course, also co-directed The Taking, a wonderful documentary that I hope you've all seen. So, and Naomi, I want to welcome to this is Majority Report 2.0, as we refer to it, sadly, and frequent guest on the first Majority Report and other shows. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you again.
Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. I have been really wanting to talk to you since what we have seen happen in the Middle East, starting with Tunisia and Egypt, now in Libya, and even before what started in Wisconsin, I was curious as to your perspective on, will this spread to this country? And I don't know that it has, but give me your sense. Give me your sense of what happened in the Middle East and then whether or not it is spreading to this country.
Well, you know, it's so fluid. It's moving so quickly. We don't even know what's happening there. But we do know that there was just this incredible moment where people shed their fear, and we witnessed such extraordinary acts of courage, and we're still witnessing them. And we also just saw something that I think is really important to be reminded of, which is that power is always more frail than we think. And when you see these incredibly seemingly powerful authoritarian regimes that have held on to power for, you know, 40 years, 30 years, crumble in the face of street demonstrations, I think it does remind the world that people power can work. And that's a lesson that we, you know, we don't get taught in school. We often hear the opposite. Protest is so often mocked. So, you know, I don't think that you can have you know, a direct line from, you know, Egypt to Wisconsin. I actually think some of what we're seeing in the U.S. maybe is more connected to the sort of pushback we've been seeing for the past few months in Britain in the face of Cameron's and the coalition government's austerity measures and their use of crisis to attack public services, labor, and we've seen incredibly creative protests in the UK from students and from groups like Youth Can Cut. And I think that the labor movement in the U.S. has gained inspiration from that. But also, yeah, anytime we're reminded that actually protests do matter, they can work, and we've all gotten that from Egypt, it's a game changer. And you know, we remember that, I think, you know, from the 60s, that you know, when you hear interviews with student leaders from the 1960s, they often talk about how it was this moment of revolution around the world, and that gave them a sense that change was possible in the United States. And we may be getting a taste of that now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there's clear reason to believe that what happened in Egypt was very much a labor uprising in many respects, and I think I think at the very least it was inspiring. I mean, we actually had a message from one of the labor unions from Tahrir Square to the people of Wisconsin who were protesting these austerity measures. It's pretty fascinating in that way. But I mean,
But you know what? It's interesting because I think the economic component of these pro-democracy uprisings is often erased from the way in which the U.S. media reports on these protests. And this isn't new. I mean, I have a chapter in the Shock Doctrine about the Tiananmen Square massacre, uprising and massacre. And when I was 18 when that happened and was getting my news from CNN, and I just sort of bought the line that it was just about, we want to be able to vote, we want to be like America, that was the narrative. But when I went back and I read Chinese scholars analyzing what had happened in Tiananmen Square, it was once again started by unions, prompted by attacks on the social safety net in China. And then that spread to the students. So it was a history that I'd never heard before. But I suspect this is true in many, many cases, that economics does drive these protests more than we're often led to believe.
Do you think that there is obviously in Egypt, for instance, the face of it, to the extent, at least to the international world, was this guy Ghonim, who was a Google executive and clearly he was living in the UAE, and he talked about how he could have sat by his pool, and so he came back for freedom and for love of his country. But clearly the tides turned on this revolution somewhere around the 9th or the 10th, I guess it was, when the labor movements really started going, where you started to see labor protests across the country. And this is coming also in the context of having like 1,600 labor strikes over the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And also a clear move by the Egyptian elite to sort of join this world plutocracy. You had Hosni Mubarak's son was a guy who actually, was visiting Davos,
exactly,
and engaging this type of activity. What is it about? Do you think the media consciously avoids this thing, or is it just simply not an attractive narrative for them to talk about labor uprisings?
I mean, I think they fired all their labor reporters a long time ago, and they don't even know how to cover it, frankly. It's just basic. It's power. It's physics. I mean, yes, it is street protests that put power on these regimes, but it's always a pincer, right? It's always an inside-outside pressure that ultimately forces them out. And when there is, and that pincer happens when the protests in the streets and labor protests are able to exert a sufficient enough economic cost on the regime that there is a split within the elites, right? Where the elites start going, wait a minute, this is costing us, and you have to do something about it. And that's when they start throwing their leaders under the bus. And, that may, that will hopefully happen in Libya, where, you have these threats to cut off oil production. And this is, I think, so long as they're willing to use this kind of extraordinary, deadly force and massacre people in the streets, there's only so far street protests are going to be able to go in that sort of a context. But if they're able to maintain economic power, if labor is actually able to exert power and sort of cut off the regime in that way, then I think ultimately that's what's going to force Gaddafi out.
That's interesting because on Tuesday there was the AFL-CIO for Madison, I guess this was on Monday, maybe it was Monday night they made this announcement, that they had passed a couple of motions to endorse the notion of a general strike and the idea of, and this is, now we're talking about private unions now,
yeah,
joining
yeah.
With public unions And just the specter of this happening, it was hoped that it would create pressure on the business community. And, of course, that's the way to get to a Scott Walker's heart, right, is to...
Yeah, and I mean, this is a big reason why there is such a profound political attack on the very idea of unions in this country, because unions are a political force. And they don't just negotiate better contracts for their, you know, for the people that they represent. They also can be political actors, whether that means getting involved in elections or whether that means organizing protests and, you know, at the extreme and general strikes. And so that's why the nature of the attacks on that we're seeing from this new crop of Republicans is really more than attacks on wages and benefits. It is about attacking the very existence of unions and their right to be political actors, so that you have a kind of a unilateral disarmament, that that our side isn't capable of a general strike only works when you have a large enough sector of the population that is unionized so that it's meaningful, right? So if people are not organized, then that threat isn't a credible threat, and this is exactly what they're afraid of. And what we're seeing is maybe the last stage of this attack on the New Deal that we've been living so aggressively over the past 35 years. And what won the New Deal? What was the force that won all these benefits that have been just systematically dismantled since Reagan? And it overwhelmingly was the ability of labor not just to bargain collectively, but to organize collectively, and to form a backbone of a progressive movement in this country.
When you say we're at the last stages, I mean, are you is this a function of the forces that would destroy those elements of the New Deal tiring themselves out, or is it simply that we're at the last stages and the last vestiges of the New Deal? And
well, there's not much left to dismantle,
right,
is what I mean.
Right.
It's hardly a done deal that they're going to win. So I think part of it is just, okay, there's been a checklist, and they've systematically been checking off a great deal of the gains. There are a few left, Social Security, and there are a few strong labor strongholds, and they're going after those. But I also think that there is genuine fear since the Wall Street created economic crisis in 2008 that this is potentially a very volatile populist moment, and that if people aren't busy attacking, minorities, immigrants, buying into this narrative of pitting public sector workers against private sector workers, then they at some point could realize that their enemies are actually on Wall Street, and that anger could go up instead of down. And so I think the aggressiveness and the energy in this moment of going after the labor movement is not just driven by, okay, there's a few things left that we haven't dismantled, let's go for it now. That's part of it. They're always up for that. But I think the energy of it is we better do this before they come after us.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that my sense is that part of the reason why there has been such energy around what's happening in Wisconsin is that this is a way to channel a lot of the frustration that progressives and, frankly, the middle class is probably feeling about Obama in some fashion. I think to a large extent there was, at least from my view, the change that people thought Obama was going to usher in was a rejiggering of the balance of corporate power in this country. And for all the people who will be who will receive. Health insurance in the future, that power balance has, to the extent that it shifted at all, it has become even more unbalanced on the side of corporate power. And this is sort of, Scott Walker is sort of a surrogate in some respects for just a general frustration out of what's coming out of Washington, be it from Republican or Democratic leaders.
Absolutely. And this is why I think a lot of it, you can see more of a continuity with what's been going on in Europe than with what's going on in the Middle East. Although, as I said, I think that, whenever you see that kind of people power, that's contagious, and people, it occurs to people that maybe it wouldn't be useless to go out to a protest. But the chant in the streets for the past 2 years in Europe has been, "We won't pay for your crisis." Mm-hmm. So starting in Greece and spreading through France and Italy, and you know now we're seeing it in the UK, and that really is, I think, underneath everything else, that is what is energizing people in Wisconsin and in other states where they're starting to mobilize. It's just an understanding that regular working people are being asked to pay the price for an economic crisis that they had absolutely nothing to do with creating, while the people who created that crisis have faced absolutely no repercussions. Are walking free, are collecting their bonuses. And, you know, as more and more research and analysis comes out to catch up to the action, which is really exciting, you know, we see that this isn't just rhetoric. I mean, there is a clear connection between, for instance, the fact that pension funds are collapsing and the economic crisis that was created on Wall Street. Why are people's investments down? Well, they're down from 2007 levels. You know, if that crisis hadn't have happened, then there wouldn't be this shortfall. The reason, you know, Wisconsin is a particular case because it's so clearly a created crisis, but lots of states are facing very real economic crises, right? And it is directly linked to the decision that was made to bail out Wall Street and, you know, not bail out homeowners and not protect jobs, and that's how you lose your tax base. You don't have a tax base, you're going to have a budget crisis. So people understand that, and they see a basic, you know, crime against fairness at work, and they're taking action. But I also do think it is significant, Sam, that you know that it is, you know, in Wisconsin, it is a fight about the right to unionize and the right to collectively bargain. I mean, in my lifetime, I don't think I remember such a pro-labor mass movement in the United States. So that's quite amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty stunning, and I have to say. As a compliment to you, that at least two people that I've interviewed talking about this have referred to this as a ginned up shock doctrine. I mean, or at least the shock doctrine a dynamic here, where you have a supposed crisis, and they use this as an opportunity to pursue an agenda, this anti-union agenda that they've had for a long time.
Which in no way is going to fix the crisis. I mean,
no,
people
not
see
at all.
That.
Not at all. I mean, I think our listeners understand that. I guess, you know, and another question that I have for you, and to see if you have a sense of this, is what is preventing? I mean, so much of this is so clear, and this has been instigated by an overreach by a governor in a state that founded collective bargaining rights for state employees. In the absence of this overreach, and you still have, you know, you still have these unions already essentially capitulating to the demands of the governor in terms of what he wants supposedly to correct his fiscal imbalance.
Which I'm not sure they should be agreeing to.
I totally agree with you. I think they should take this opportunity to get more aggressive, and make it clear where the problem is. I mean, you've got people who you cannot have a fiscal crisis that comes within weeks of giving a tax cut. You just simply cannot. It just does not make any sense.
Well, this has been the genius of the UK strategy, where you know, coalition government comes to power. By its very nature, it doesn't have a majority mandate to rule, right? Coalition governments are supposed to be conciliatory, because you know the Tories only want a minority. And they make coalition with the Liberal Democrats, who ran actively against the vast majority of the policies that the Tories are governing under. So that's a situation where you don't have a mandate for shock and awe politics by any stretch, by any definition of democracy. Yet they go in and they do things that Margaret Thatcher, you know, never dreamed of. And they, you know, close off possibilities for working class kids to go to university, students mobilize. But then you have this group that comes along called UK Uncuts. And their strategy is, okay, let's go after the corporations that have paid almost no taxes, that have dodged their taxes, whether legally or illegally or in some gray area. And it's this wonderful sort of marriage between great research and great organizing. And they become sort of direct action tax collectors. They go to the doorstep of these high street stores like Vodafone and Topshop, and now they're going after the banks. And, you know, they just had this incredible action a couple of days ago where they went to Barclays banks across the country. So they use brands. I mean, this is actually related to the first book I wrote, No Logo, where they're using sort of the infrastructure of globalization, of the ubiquity of some of these brands to be able to have decentralized protests across the country. Everybody's got one of these banks in their communities. Everybody's got one of these stores in their communities. So they're able to be everywhere at once. They show up at the banks and they come to collect the taxes, and they make the argument, if you paid your taxes, we wouldn't have to be cutting our daycares and education and hospitals. And so the action they had a couple of days ago was, they called it a bail-in as opposed to a bail-out, where they went into these banks and sort of did street theater of, you know, having medical clinics or daycares or, you know, teachers' health classes, really making the point, you know, this is what we are losing because you are gaining. And that's so important because, you know, if you have a movement that's just saying stop the cuts, stop the cuts, stop the cuts, but isn't saying, okay, here's where you can get the money instead, here's our alternative vision, then just, you're going to look unrealistic. And what we need to do now is really force, okay, who should be paying instead of public sector employees? And that's the next stage. And, you know, there's a group in the U.S. that's just formed called U.S. Uncuts, and they're going to have their first National Day of Action on February 26th, coming up fast.
And, you know, the interesting thing is that the same dynamic in Wisconsin, where we see the corporations, I think something like 65% of corporations in Wisconsin haven't paid any taxes.
And the whole agenda is for them to pay less, right? So certainly the climate is ripe for this kind of sort of investigative activism, right, where it isn't just about the mass protests, though those are hugely important, but combining that with some really great research and direct action.
Are we going to have to wait for this type of wide-scale austerity in this country until we see some broader-based action? I mean, my concern is that we have a similar dynamic to what you're referring to in the U.K. We very well may see cuts in Social Security benefits under the guise of raising the age of retirement or means testing in some respect for Social Security. We may see that with a Democrat sitting in the presidency and control of the Senate in a way that we would have never seen if George Bush was president.
No, this is really key, and this comes back to what you were talking about before, about whether Walker is some kind of a surrogate, that people are finding their spines, in part because they don't have to take on Obama, you know? Mm-hmm. And we've seen some of this in California as well. You know, California got hit really hard with the first wave of these cuts. I think they were a little smarter in that, you know, the cuts mostly, the first wave of cuts really mostly affected minority communities. They went after schools in minority neighborhoods that were losing a third of their teachers, but there wasn't the kind of solidarity that we're seeing in Wisconsin because I think they were smart enough not to go after some of the more middle class unions at mm-hmm. the same time. But, you know, I always say, you know, the right always overreaches and they always create our coalitions for us because ultimately they'll go after so many people at the same time that our movements sort of, you know, emerge in the rubble of that. But, yeah, the real question in the U.K., they've got their boogeyman. You know, they've got their Thatcher reincarnated and you have a progressive movement that, you know, has a clear enemy. In the U.S., it's always going to be a huge challenge with a Democrat in power because you're always going to have so many liberals making apologies for them.
Right. And to a certain extent, is the whole idea of tax cuts across the board, is that sort of like the letting the air out of the tire a little bit? I mean, is that the way that they co-opt these type of movements? It's like, well, yes, we may have tough times, but at least I get a tax cut. And that's what keeps people in their houses? Or is it simply you know, I guess I'm wondering at what point do we reach where austerity, unemployment is.
Look, we have so passed the point that, you know, any other country would have been in open revolt. So, I mean, the idea that we have to wait for it to get really way worse before people are going to act, you know, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin is courage is contagious, you know. Also, victories are contagious. Right. So when people start seeing that this can work, that it's fun, that it's better than just staying at home complaining, feeling miserable, that it starts to spread. I think that that's much more of a tipping point than, you know, waiting for something, you know, so awful. Because, you know, I think that the decisions that have been made over the past 3 years, in the impunity on Wall Street, the outrageous transfer of public money into private hands, and then turning around and asking the most vulnerable people to pay the price for a crisis that was created, you know, by the most spoiled elites one can imagine. That's enough for a massive uprising, and we don't need more than that. The question is, you know, really, what are the, you know, what are the psychologies? What are the barriers within progressive / liberal narratives that prevent that? That co-opt that energy. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just having elections every 2 years where suddenly there's a huge amount of pressure on people to line up behind the Democrats, you know, to just say, you know, this election is the only thing that matters. You know, we saw that happen with the anti-war movement, right, where you had a large, vibrant anti-war movement, and then it sort of turned into, you know, let's get rid of Bush movement. And that's not the same as an anti-war movement, and as we've seen, because we're still stuck with these wars.
And how do we fight against that? I mean, because frankly, I fall into that same trap. I mean, the
it's hard because the right in the U.S. is so incredibly insane and scary.
Right.
You know?
I mean, that's the thing, is that I don't want, you know, Sarah Palin. I don't think actually she would be a blessing on some level for a GOP nominee. But I don't want any Republican sitting in the White House. But that said, you know, I look at Obama and I think, gosh, you know, I almost, if we're getting Bloomberg's policies, why not have Bloomberg in there so that we still can retain the Democratic Party as some type of potential vehicle in the future for helping the middle class? Because if Obama sits, presides over a cut in Social Security, then we're left with no vehicle, even as shoddy of a one as the Democratic Party has clearly become. What can we do to keep us from falling into that trap?
Well, personally, I think what you do is you put your head down and you build the movements that you need and believe in. And those movements, you know, if Democratic politicians want to use those movements, then they're there. I mean, this is what we're seeing in Wisconsin. If you do have, once again, that sort of pincer where first you had a strong pushback from the unions, a mobilization, but then that gave courage to Democrat lawmakers to hold up their end of the bargain and to, you know, to act with more courage than I think we've seen from the Democrats in a long time, right? Mm-hmm. And to, you know, to leave the state, to refuse to give them quorum. We'll see what happens. You know, I'm always nervous whenever anything depends on the courage of Democrat lawmakers because, you know, we'll see how long it lasts. But what you do see at least a glimpse of in this dynamic is that it isn't an either or. When you have strong independent social movements that are clear on what their values are and what their goals are, it moves the center. You know, it creates a strong left, and it's clear once again what the center is. So, you know, I've been saying this, you know, for years now about Obama. I hope I'm right. But that, you know, ultimately the one thing we know about this guy is that he's a centrist. And so it's the goal of the left, progressives, whatever you want to call them, to be out there and staking a strong left pole in the debate so that the middle is a reasonable middle. Because without that mobilization, without that independent, clear vision from the left, then, you know, he'll be triangulating between, you know, a mushy middle and an insane right, which is what he's been doing.
And so ultimately, a victory here for people on the ground in Wisconsin is not necessarily hinged upon whether or not they can stop Scott Walker in this instance, but rather whether or not the energy can be maintained.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think at this point, you know, it's a victory no matter what they've accomplished and the kind of, you know, courage that has already spread across the country. You know, you think about that little factory in Chicago right after the 2008 elections. These workers at the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago who decided that they were not going to accept having their factory closed down. They occupied their plant and they became a symbol across the country. But that was, you know, that was a couple hundred workers,
right.
And this is, you know, tens of thousands. And so the effects of this are going to be tremendous no matter what happens. That said, if they won, it would be really great. And of course, you know, we hope they will, and I think they might.
Well, Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine, No Logo, and co-director of The Taking, very reminiscent of what happened in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'd love to talk to you again soon.
It was wonderful talking to you, Sam. Thanks.
Don't get paid.